He should have been made aware of who his opponent was. He should have been made aware of why he had to die. All that noble man-to-man stuff. But real life wasn't like that. Joe would have laughed at all that. I swung the sap with all my strength at his head. Just as he turned to walk back to the house, the sap glanced off the slick nylon and the momentum of a heavy lead-filled tube pulled me hopelessly off balance. I was falling like a man on ice. The kid spun and raised the shotgun, pumped a shell into the chamber. I flung my arm up and knocked the barrel aside, rolled right under his field of fire. He squeezed the trigger and there was an enormous explosion, louder than the worst of the thunder. I heard leaves tearing and ripping as the shot smashed into the trees beyond us. The ferocious recoil rocked him back, but he pumped the second shell. I heard the menacing double crunch-crunch of the mechanism. I was on my back on the poolside tiles, but I lunged up and grabbed the gun with both hands, forced the barrel up and the stock down, and he fired into the air again. Another terrifying explosion. This time, I pulled with the recoil and tore the gun out of his hands, thrust up and jabbed the stock at his face. It was a poor blow. The Ithaca has a big rubber pad on the stock. It protects the shooter's shoulder from the savage recoil. Now it protected the kid's head from my jab. He just rocked back. I dove at his legs and slammed him backward, swiped at his feet and tripped him into the pool. He splashed in on his back. I jumped in on top of him. We were in the deep end of the pool, thrashing about for the winning hold. The rain was hammering, chlorine was burning my eyes and nose. I fought on until I got his throat, tore the nylon hood back, and got my hands right on his neck, locked my arms, and thrust the kid's head far under the water. I was crushing his throat with all my strength. That biker in Warburton had thought he was doing a job on me, but that had been like a lover's caress compared to what I was doing to the Kleiner kid. I was tearing his head off. I squeezed and wrenched and held him a yard underwater until he died. Didn't take long. Never does in that situation. The first guy under stays under. It could have been me. I was treading water and gasping through the chlorine stink. The rain was chopping up the surface. It was impossible to tell where the water ended and the air began. I let his body float off and swam to the side, clung on and got my breath. The weather was a nightmare. The thunder was now a continuous roar and the lightning blazed in sheets. The rain was a relentless downpour. It would have kept me drier to stay in the pool, but I had things to do. I swam back to fetch the kid's body. It was floating a yard down. I towed it back to the side, hauled myself out, grabbed a bunch of nylon in each hand and dragged the body out after me. It weighed a ton. It lay on the poolside with water gushing out of the suit at the wrists and ankles. I left it there and staggered back up toward the garage. Walking was not easy. My clothes were soaking wet and cold. It was like walking in chain mail. But I made it to the garage and found the key, unlocked the door and hit the light. It was a three-car garage, just the other Bentley in there. Hubble's own car, same vintage as Charlie's, gorgeous dark green, lovingly polished to a deep gloss. I could see my reflection in the paint as I moved about. I was looking for a wheelbarrow or a garden truck, whatever gardeners use. The garage was full of garden gear, a big ride-on mower, hoses, tools. In the far corner, a sort of a barrel thing with big spoke wheels like a bicycle. I wheeled it out into the storm and down to the pool, scrabbled around and found the two shotguns and the wet sap, dropped the shotguns in the barrel and put the sap back in my pocket, checked that the kid's corpse still had its shoes on and heaved it into the barrel, wheeled it up to the house and down the driveway, squeezed it past the Bentley and rolled it around to the back of the truck. I opened the rear doors and heaved the corpse inside, scrambled up and dragged it well in. The rain was clattering on the roof. Then I lifted the first guy's body in and dragged it up next to the Kleiner kid, threw the shotguns in on top of them. Two stowed. Then I took the barrel up to where I'd piled the other three. They were sprawled on the soaking lawn with the rain roaring on their hideous suits. I wheeled them back to the truck they'd come in. Got all five laid out inside. Then I ran the barrel back through the deluge to the garage, put it back in the corner where I'd found it, took a flashlight from the workbench. I wanted to get a look at the four boys young Kleiner had brought with him. I ran back through the rain to the truck and stepped up inside, switched on the flashlight, and crouched over the forlorn row of corpses. The Kleiner kid I knew. The other four, I pulled back their hoods and tore away their masks, played the flashlight beam over their faces. Two of them were the gate men from the warehouse. I'd watched them through the field glasses on Thursday, and I was sure of it. Maybe I wouldn't have sworn to it in a court-martial, but I wasn't interested in that kind of a judicial procedure tonight. The other two, I did know for sure. No doubt about it. They were police. They were the backup crew from Friday. They'd come with Baker and Stevenson to the diner to arrest me. I'd seen them around the station house a few times since. They had been inside the scam. More of Mayor Thiel's concealed troops. I scrambled out of the truck again and took the flashlight back to the garage, locked up the doors and ran through the rain to the front of the house, scooped up the two bags they'd brought, dumped them inside Hubble's hallway and hit the light, looked through the bags, spare gloves and masks, a box of 10-gauge shotgun shells, a hammer, a bag of 6-inch nails, and 4 knives, medical type of thing. They could cut you just looking at them. I picked up the crowbar from where they'd dropped it after breaking the lock, put it in one of the bags, carried the bags down to the truck and hurled them in on top of the 5 bodies. Then I shut and locked the rear doors and ran through the lashing rain up to the house again. I ran through and locked up the garden room, ran back to the kitchen. I opened the oven door and emptied my pockets, laid everything out on the floor, found a couple of baking sheets in the next cupboard. I stripped down the Desert Eagle and laid the parts carefully on one of the trays, piled the spare bullets next to them, put the knife, the sap, the Bentley keys, and my money and papers on the other tray. I put the trays in the oven and turned the heat on very low. I went out the front and pulled the splintered door as far shut as it would go, ran past the Bentley and got into the Kleiner Foundation truck, fiddled with the unfamiliar key and started it up, reversed carefully down the driveway and swung backward out onto Beckman Drive, rolled down the slope to town. The windshield wipers beat furiously against the rain. I skirted the big square with the church, made the right turn at the bottom, and headed south. The place was deserted. Nobody else on the road. 300 yards south of the village green, I turned into Morrison's driveway, drove the truck up to the house and parked it next to his abandoned Lincoln, locked the door, ran over to Morrison's boundary fence and hurled the keys far into the field beyond, shrugged my jacket tight around me and started walking back through the rain, started thinking hard. Saturday was already more than an hour old, therefore Sunday was less than a day away. The shape of the thing was clear. I had 3 facts for sure. Fact 1, Kleiner needed special paper. Fact 2, it wasn't obtainable in the States. But fact 3, the warehouse was jammed with something. And the writing on those air conditioner boxes was bothering me. Not the Island air conditioning ink, not the printed bit, the other writing, the serial numbers. The boxes I'd seen had handwritten serial numbers in printed rectangles. I'd seen them quite clearly. The Jacksonville cops had described the same thing on the boxes in Stoller's speeding truck. Long, handwritten serial numbers. But why? The boxes themselves were good cover, good camouflage. Hauling something secret to Florida and beyond in air conditioner boxes was a smart move. No product was more plausible for the markets down there. The boxes had fooled the Jacksonville cops. They hadn't thought twice about it. But the serial numbers bothered me. If there were no electrical appliances in the boxes, why write serial numbers on them? That was taking camouflage to absurd lengths. So what the hell did the serial numbers mean? What the hell had been in those damn boxes? That was the question I was asking myself. In the end, it was Joe who answered it for me. I was walking along in the rain, thinking about what Kelstein had said about precision. He had said Joe had a very attractive precision about the manner in which he expressed himself. I knew that. I was thinking about the neat little list he'd printed out for himself, the proud capital letters, the rows of initials, the column of telephone numbers, the two notes at the bottom. Stoller's Garage, Gray's Kleiner File. I needed to check the list again. But I was suddenly sure Joe was telling me if I wanted to know what Kleiner had been putting into those boxes, it might be worth going up to the Stoller's Garage and taking a look. Chapter 27. First thing I did back at the house was root around in Charlie Hubble's expensive kitchen for coffee. Started the machine burbling away, then I opened up the oven, got all my things out. They had been warmed for the best part of an hour, and they were bone dry. The leather on the sap and the keyring had stiffened up some. Other than that, no damage. I put the gun back together and loaded it, left it on the kitchen table, cocked and locked. Then I checked Joe's computer printout for the confirmation I thought was there. But there was a problem. A major problem. The paper was bone dry and crisp, but the writing had gone. The paper was completely blank. The swimming pool water had washed all the ink off. There were very faint, blurred smudges, but I couldn't make out the words. I shrugged to myself. I'd read it through 100 times. I'd rely on my memory of what it had said. Next stop was the basement. I fiddled around with the furnace until it kicked in. Then I stripped off and shoved all my clothes in Charlie's electric dryer. Set it on low for an hour. I had no idea what I was doing. In the army, some corporal had done my laundry. Took it away, brought it back clean and folded. Since then, I always bought cheap stuff and just junked it. I walked upstairs naked and went into Hubble's bathroom. Took a long, hot shower and scrubbed the mascara off my face. Stood for a long time in the hot water. Wrapped myself up in a towel and went down for the coffee. I couldn't go up to Atlanta that night. I couldn't get there before maybe 4:30 in the morning. That was the wrong time to be sure of talking my way inside. I had no ID to show and no proper status. A night visit could turn into a problem. I would have to leave it until the morning, first thing. No choice. So I thought about sleeping. I turned the kitchen radio off and wandered through to Hubble's den. Turned the television off. Looked around. It was a dark, snug room. Lots of wood paneling and big leather chairs. Next to the television was a stereo. Some kind of a Japanese thing. Rows of compact discs and cassette tapes. Big emphasis on the Beatles. Hubble had said he'd been interested in John Lennon. He'd been to the Dakota in New York City and to Liverpool in England. He had just about everything. All the albums, a few bootlegs, that singles collection on CD they sold in a wooden box. Over the desk was a bookshelf, stacks of professional periodicals and a row of heavy books, technical banking journals and reports. The professional periodicals took up a couple of feet of shelf space. They looked pretty deadly. Random copies of something calling itself the Banking Journal. A couple of issues of a solid magazine called Bank Management. One called Banker. Banker's Magazine, Banker's Monthly, Business Journal, Business Week, Cash Management Bulletin, The Economist, The Financial Post. All filed in line with the alphabet, all in neat date order. Just random copies ranging back over the last few years. No complete sets. At the end of the row were some U.S. Treasury Department dispatches and a couple of issues of something calling itself World of Banking. A curious collection. Seemed very selective. Maybe they were especially heavy issues. Maybe Hubble had read them through when he couldn't sleep. I wasn't going to have any trouble sleeping. I was on my way out of the den, off to find a bed to borrow, when something occurred to me. I stepped back to the desk and peered at the bookshelf again. Ran my finger along the row of magazines and journals. Checked the dates printed on the spines, under the pompous titles. Some of them were recent issues. The random sequence continued right up to the latest issue of a couple of them. More than a dozen were from this year. Fully a third of them were published after Hubble had left his job at the bank. After he had been let go. They were published for bankers, but by then Hubble hadn't been a banker anymore. But he had still been ordering up these heavy professional journals, He had still been getting them, still reading all this complicated stuff. Why? I pulled out a couple of the periodicals, looked at the covers. They were thick, glossy magazines. I held them in my fingers at the top and bottom of the spines. They fell open at the pages Hubble had consulted. I looked at those pages, pulled out some more issues, let them fall open. I sat down in Hubble's leather chair. I sat there, wrapped in his towel, reading. I read right through the shelf, from left to right, from beginning to end, all the periodicals. It took me an hour. Then I started in on the books. I ran my finger along the dusty row, stopped with a little shock when I spotted a couple of names I knew, Kelstein and Bartholomew, a big old volume bound in red leather, their Senate subcommittee report. I pulled it out and started flicking through. It was an amazing publication. Kelstein had modestly described it as the anti-counterfeiter's Bible, and it was. He'd been too modest. It was totally exhaustive. It was a painstaking history of every known forging technique. Copious examples and instances were taken from every racket ever discovered. I hefted the heavy volume onto my lap, read for another solid hour. At first, I concentrated on paper problems. Kelstein had said that paper was the key. He and Bartholomew had provided a long appendix about paper. It expanded on what he told me face to face. The cotton and linen fibers, the chemical colorant, the introduction of the red and blue polymer threads. The paper was produced in Dalton, Massachusetts by an outfit called Crane & Company. I nodded to myself. I'd heard of them. Seemed to me I'd bought some Christmas cards made by them. I remembered the thick, heavy card and the creamy rag envelopes. I'd liked them. The company had been making currency stock for the Treasury since 1879. For over a century, it had been trucked down to Washington under heavy guard in armored cars. None had ever been stolen, not a single sheet. Then I flipped backward from the appendix and started looking at the main text. I piled Hubble's little library on his desk, trawled through it all again. Some things I read twice, three times. I kept diving back into the untidy sprawl of dense articles and reports, checking, cross-referencing, trying to understand the arcane language. I kept going back to the big red Senate report. There were three paragraphs I read over and over again. The first was about an old counterfeiting ring in Bogota, Colombia. The second was about a much earlier Lebanese operation. The Christian phalangists had teamed up with some Armenian engravers during an old civil war. The third was some basic stuff about chemistry. Lots of complicated formulas, but there were a few words I recognized. I read the three paragraphs time and time again. I wandered through to the kitchen, picked up Joe's blank list, stared at it for a long time, wandered back to the dark, quiet den, and sat in a pool of light and thought and read for hours, halfway through the night.